From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
2021 was supposed to be the year when we returned to normal life, more or less. Instead, at the moment, we have lockdowns in New South Wales, Melbourne, and now the ACT. After an earlier impressive economic rebound, we're facing a negative September quarter, with the December quarter looking very problematic. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is with us today to discuss the economic consequences of our COVID third wave. Josh Frydenberg, do you think we're headed for a recession, another recession?
Well, I am expecting the September quarter to be negative, and that is because we've had our largest states, namely New South Wales and Victoria, in lockdown. But the resilience of the Australian economy would indicate that once restrictions eased, that the economy will bounce back strongly. The median market expectation for the September quarter is for a contraction of around 1.5%, Michelle. To put that into context, the economy contracted by 7% in the June quarter last year. So certainly the economic shock last year was far greater than what we're seeing now. We also know from bank data that consumer spending is about 30% higher today than it was in March and April last year. The consumer confidence similarly is around 30% higher than it was back then. And even since the end of JobKeeper, the latest jobs numbers had showed that over 200,000 people had come off unemployment benefits since that program ended. So I'm confident that the underlying fundamentals of the Australian economy is sound, and that while we do face challenges today, it's very difficult indeed, that the economy will bounce back.
But the December quarter is still pretty much up in the air, isn't it?
Well, we don't know what we don't know, and that's why we have to take all the health and economic steps that available to us to not only mitigate the spread of the virus, but also the economic impact that it's having.
The situation in New South Wales is really bad and doesn't seem to be getting better anytime soon. Do you think you will have to announce more stimulus, more support, or do you think you've got enough in place already?
Well, I think we've got the right programs that are in place, namely for households. Income support is being provided, as you know, $450 a week if you've lost between 8 and 19 hours of work, and if you've lost 20 hours or more of work in a week, you're entitled to a $750 payment. There's a broader cohort of people who are receiving this payment indeed than under JobKeeper, because casuals, if they were long-term casuals, they were receiving JobKeeper payments, but short-term casuals were not, whereas this particular program doesn't discriminate in any way. What we've also seen with those payments is that around $2 billion has already gone out the door since July, and the vast proportion of that is in New South Wales. And then on top of the individual income support, we have business payments, and we entered into an agreement with the New South Wales government for a 50-50 split so that businesses with a turnover between $75,000 and $250 million a year could receive between $1,500 and $100,000 a week, depending on the size of their business. And this was roughly equivalent to 40% of their payroll. This program, which also provides support to sole traders of $1,000 a week, is designed to help those businesses meet their fixed costs, whether it's rent, payments to banks, other electricity, water, gas bills that they may, maintenance requirements that they may have, on top of obviously the income support that's been directly provided to their workers.
Now, looking at external factors, The Chinese economy is slowing.
Mm.
What are the implications of this for Australia?
Well, the Chinese economy, just as it was during the GFC, has also been remarkably resilient. And we're seeing that play out, for example, in their demand for our resources. And we had a record trade surplus in recent months. I mean, in June it was $10.5 billion. There is strong demand for our exports out of China, but the IMF forecast is for China to continue to grow strongly. It's been 7 to 8%, with China, given the size of its economy, growing that strongly, that does mean that demand for our goods and services will continue to come from that country.
So you don't expect demand to fall off
significantly? There may be in particular markets impacts, but overall the trajectory has been that demand for some of those base commodities has been strong. I mean, of course, there's been issues between Australia and China, which is having an impact in the trade sphere. There's no secret at that. But if you look at the iron ore price, around $160 a tonne, I've got it in the budget at $55 a tonne. So it's significantly up on where our more conservative projections have been.
Now, just to go to the support which you outlined, what's better about the design of the latest iteration of job support than JobKeeper?
Well, the payments through Services Australia have gone out very quickly. In some cases, the money is being delivered within the hour of the application. More than 90% of the applications have been online. So the feedback from people who are using the MyGov site and with Services Australia has been that money has flowed very quickly, and I think
Have problems, of course.
In the respect of getting money out to people who need it, and they obviously have to, comply with the requirements and the eligibility.
But there's not time for checking.
Well, all those checks, auditing, will be done, is being done by the relevant authorities. But it is important that there is an accessibility to these programs and that people can work with them and they're not overly complex, and that's the feedback to date.
For all the good that it did, and it did a lot of good, we now know that quite a lot of money was wasted in JobKeeper, with many companies that ended up making profits, keeping the money they received, and some companies not passing on the funds as they should have to their workers. Looking back, should that have been more tightly designed? Do you concede that?
Well, I actually think that JobKeeper has been a remarkable success, and you've even heard the Governor of the Reserve Bank describe it as a remarkable program. And it certainly played a big role in the very strong economic rebound that we've seen. You know, unemployment has come down to 4.9%, the lowest in a decade. We saw in the back half of last year two consecutive quarters of very strong economic growth, which was indeed the strongest in more than a half a century. Australia's economy is bigger today than it was going into the pandemic. Indeed, there are 160,000 more people in work today than going into the pandemic. That is not the experience of any other advanced economy.
But you do.
That has been a very strong a very strong recovery, and JobKeeper has played a key role. But if we wind the clock back, Michelle, to when we put in place JobKeeper, we were facing an economic abyss. Treasury had come to me and said the unemployment rate could reach as high as 15%. That's more than 2 million unemployed. They were talking about a contraction in economic growth of potentially more than 20%. And you remember the fear that was very clear across the economy as tens of thousands of our fellow Australians were lining up outside Centrelink. JobKeeper helped stem that tide of job losses, and it quickly restored confidence immediately after it was announced. Now, initially it was for a 6-month period, and as you know, it was based on an anticipated decline in turnover. And so the businesses that received it were complying with the law. We then extended it for another 6 months, and that is following a Treasury review, which found that it was a very well-targeted program, and indeed it found that the average decline had been more than that 30% that we had set. And we introduced a 2-tiered payment based on the number of hours worked, and then we tapered the payment down. Again, the numbers of people came off, numbers of people came off it as the economy strengthened. And then when we ended it, I think that was very much the right decision because it was at the time costing more than $2 billion a month. Our political opponents said the economic sky, the economic roof would come crashing in and the sky, you know, would fall into and, you know, the world would, you know, come to an end if we ended JobKeeper. Well, none of that happened. And that that hyperbole, to use a Julia Gillard phrase, you know, it was a complete over-exaggeration as to what the impact would be. So we did the right thing. We ended that program. And now we've put in other programs that are really fit for purpose to support the economy.
But you do remember the Coalition's ferocious attacks on Labor's programs during the GFC and its talk about the waste in the schools hall program and so on.
But again, you go back to when we introduced this program. If we had said at the time, Grattan Enterprises would have to pay it all back if somehow they got through the crisis, the likelihood would have been that businesses wouldn't have taken, some businesses wouldn't have taken that money and therefore they would have let their staff go. And this kept the formal connection between employer and employee. It helped hibernate the economy and then the economy bounced back very strongly. And we wanted to get the money out the door quickly because the economy needed that that support and that stimulus. At the same time, the United Kingdom had a different program where workers had been furloughed and they calibrated the amount that employers would receive or employees would receive based on a percentage of their previous income. Now, we looked at that program, but we decided against it and we chose an egalitarian approach, an Australian way with that flat $1,500 payment. So I think, looking back, it was a very effective program. It's certainly a costly program, but it's one that has been a springboard to our strong economic recovery. And it's disappointing, I have to say, that the opposition is seeking, to diminish the achievements of JobKeeper. When it's obvious that unions and churches and small businesses and all the other groups were getting this money, but you don't hear them talk about the unions receiving JobKeeper. You only hear them talk about the small businesses or the churches and how they should pay it back. Well, I think that's wrong. The businesses at the time did comply with the law. If there are very successful businesses today that are in a position to put that money back, then we would welcome that. But they're under no legal obligation to do so.
So in sum, you'd say that some wastage was inevitable given the size of the crisis and the needs to prop up the situation.
I would say that the program was very effective in getting money out the door to people who needed it most. And those businesses had to have an anticipated decline in turnover. A standard business was around 30% or less. We actually had a lower threshold, as you may remember, for not-for-profits at 15%, and we had a higher threshold at 50% for businesses with a turnover above a billion. So what we sought to do here was have different thresholds for different types of businesses, recognising that there was great need out there.
Now, in the crisis last year, you doubled Job Seeker.
Mm.
This time, there are no special measures for unemployed people on the basic Job Seeker. I understand that you've got the payment for those who earn a bit more and have lost hours. But why have you not gone back and increased that basic amount?
Well, we actually have provided, as you were alluding to, Michelle, a $200 payment.
Where you've earned more.
Where you have lost 8 or more hours of work, but you're actually on income support. And that is going to be money that, you know, people may not have been earning because of the health restrictions, and they may have been able to previously receive their welfare support, but also earn that income because they had the income-free area that attached to those payments. So I think this is, again, a common-sense, practical solution for those people who have been previously on welfare but were also working some hours. They can now get compensated during these lockdowns.
But it doesn't help those on the basic payment.
Well, we haven't replicated every program that we had in the first iteration of the crisis.
Is there some reason for this?
Well, you say the one other thing to point out to you is we've increased the base rate of the Job Seeker payment, which was not increased formally or legislatively in the first iteration of the crisis last year.
Can we talk about migration when we've got no immigration virtually? What's been the effect of this, and what prospects do you see for getting at least some skilled migrants back in, and what about foreign students?
Well, migration is a very important part of the Australian success story. You and I, one way or another, are products of this country's open arms to the rest of the world. And long may that continue. And from an economic point of view, population is one of those three drivers of economic growth: population, participation and productivity. Now, as a result of our closed borders, population growth has fallen to 0.1%, the lowest in a century. Net overseas migration has gone negative for the first time in decades as more people have left the country than have come to the country. That is having an impact on the economy. And one of the common refrains from businesses that before the recent lockdowns in New South Wales and Victoria was actually that they were struggling to get workers. There was a shortage of workers across the country. So we will obviously open up the borders when it's safe to do so. We had an assumption in this year's budget that the international borders will gradually reopen from the middle of next year. That will obviously depend on where the health situation is at the time.
Could be later.
Well, it will depend on what the health situation is at the time. It could be earlier too. It's just an assumption, not a policy decision. And with respect to skilled migrants and students, again, where it's safe to do so, you could potentially move with to bring in small cohorts of those people, again, when it's safe to do so, when we've worked those issues through with the states. We were working with the states about international students prior to the recent lockdowns, where they were looking to bring in small cohorts of students that were approved by the chief medical officer that were above their existing quarantine caps. There was work that was being done in that regard. It's a very difficult environment with respect to the international borders. But the broader picture, I would say, is that migration has been a real net positive for this country, but it also helps dealing with the aging of the population, which is a key takeout of successive intergenerational reports. The percentage of migrants that are under the age of 35 pre-pandemic was above 80%, which compared to across the broader population, it's at 46%. And again, there was some interesting work on this in this year's intergenerational report, which showed that, you know, with the proportion of working age Australians to those aged over 65 coming down quite substantially, you know, from over 6 to 1 in 1982 to, you know, just to 2.7 to 1 at the end of the projected 40-year period, we're going to have to deal with the impacts and the consequences of an ageing population economically, and migration is one of the ways to respond.
So when we get through this and the borders are open and we're back to some sort of normality, would you like to see migration back at the level it was before the pandemic?
I certainly would like to see migration pick up, and it will gradually get back to where it was.
And it should be back to where it was?
Well, I didn't have a problem with our migration program.
Some of your colleagues did.
Well, I think it's got to always strike the right balance in terms of composition, and that composition obviously goes to our humanity with the resettlement of refugees. It goes to the immediate needs of the economy with skilled workers, and then it goes to the harmony of our society with family reunion and the like. And
so you were okay with all those things before?
Well, I certainly think they're important features, absolutely, of our migration settings and our population story. They are very important, and like, I'm a beneficiary of that. But you've always got to get the balance right, and that is what we always seek to do.
Now, this week we had a report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which painted a very grim picture for the future. Is there a threat to foreign investment in Australia if we don't strengthen our climate policies? And what's your message to potential foreign investors who are concerned about our settings at the moment?
Well, the first thing I'd say is when Australia signs up to targets, we have historically not just met those targets, we've actually beaten them, as we did with earlier Kyoto targets, and which we're on track to do with the Paris 2030 target of a 26 to 28% reduction by 2030 on 2005 levels. And the take-up of renewable energy technology in Australia has been very dramatic, and it's been over a sustained period of time. And to see Australia, for example, now have the highest uptake of rooftop solar on a per capita basis anywhere in the world, and to see our investments through our technology investment roadmap, that can help drive $80 billion worth of investment. The hydrogen plan that we have laid out, and that the partnerships we're building with Singapore and Germany and the United Kingdom and a range of other countries in terms of the renewable energy space, I find very exciting. Now, with respect to our international reputation, again, we are reducing our carbon footprint in a responsible way. And if you look at where we are in terms of our Paris targets, our emissions are down by about 20%. In the last 3 years, we've taken the equivalent of 15 million cars off the road. So progress is being made. But, you know, I was around these issues, as you remember, Michelle, quite a lot as the energy and the environment minister.
And well, that wasn't always a happy experience.
Well, I think for successive ministers, it's never been an easy portfolio. But I was always seeking to strike the right balance between, you know, the engineering, the economics, obviously, and the environmental outcomes, and trying to get that balance right. And it was a hard time, but I think we have made progress, and wonderful projects like Snowy 2.0, I think, you know, will help balance the grid and ensure the sustainability of our energy
system. So you're not worried about the message that foreign investors might take?
Well, I think we've got an important message to communicate, which is the success we're having in reducing our carbon footprint and the partnerships that we're striking internationally and our commitment to meeting and beating our Paris targets.
Now, what about the threat by foreign governments to impose penalties over climate?
Well, again, there's lots of speculation about certain countries may or may not do, but our experience in the free trade agreements that we've been striking, both multilaterally and bilaterally, is that we work through all the relevant issues, and we've got partnerships and agreements that will help spur Australia's trade and therefore create more jobs.
Maybe you've got Matthias Kuhlmann there to put in a word for us as well.
Well, obviously he's flying the Australian flag in Paris at the OECD, and it's great to see him ascend to that role. But indeed, Michelle, the OECD has been quite upbeat about the strength of the Australian economy and the bounce back that we've seen.
Now, just finally, the election will be somewhere between March and May. What do you expect the economy will look like by then?
Well, obviously, we'll update our economic numbers at MIEFO at the end of the year. The RBA has recently put out some of its forecasts, and it's suggesting that economic growth will be a little over 4% next year. And the
That's the financial year or the calendar year?
That's in the economic growth in the calendar year 22. But the view is that unemployment may take a little bit of a hit in the context of the recent challenges that we've faced, but we're more likely to see the impact in the participation rate and hours worked. With respect to the trend, though, in the labour market, it has been on a down. It has seen the headline rate come down quite significantly, and we hope that continues. Although we're getting some new economic labour force data on Thursday, and that's probably going to reflect the recent events that we've seen in New South Wales and Victoria.
Josh Frydenberg, thank you very much for talking with us today, and that's all for our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. That's all for now, but we'll be back with another interview soon.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.